Book 6. So spoke Aeneas, weeping, and gave the ships their head, and at long last they glided to land at the Euboean colony of Cumae. The prows were turned out to sea, the teeth of the anchors held, and they moored with their curved sterns fringing the shore. Gleaming in the sun, an eager band of warriors rushed out onto the shore of the land of Hesperia, some searching for the seeds of flame hidden in the veins of flint, some raiding the dense woods, the haunts of wild beasts, and pointing the way to rivers they had found. But the devout Aeneas made for the citadel where Apollo sits throned on high, and for the vast cave standing there apart, the retreat of the awesome Sibyl, into whom Delian Apollo, the god of prophecy, breathes mind and spirit as he reveals to her the future. They were soon coming up into the grove of Diana Trivia and Apollo's golden shrine. They say that when Daedalus was fleeing from the kingdom of Minos, he dared to trust his life to the sky, floating off on swiftly driving wings towards the cold stars of the north, the greater and lesser bears, by a route no man had ever gone before, until at last he was hovering lightly in the air above the citadel of Chalcidian Cumae. Here he first returned to earth, dedicating to Phoebus Apollo the wings that had awed him through the sky, and founding a huge temple. On its doors were depicted the death of Androgeus, son of Minos, and then the Athenians, the descendants of Cecrops, ordered to pay a cruel penalty and yield up each year the living bodies of 7 of their sons. The lots are drawn, and there stands the urn. Answering this on the other door are Knossos and the land of Crete rising from the sea. Here can be seen the loving of the savage bull and Pasiphae laid out to receive it and deceive her husband Minos. Here too is the hybrid offspring, the Minotaur, half man and half animal, the memorial to a perverted love. And here is its home, built with such great labour, the inextricable labyrinth. But Daedalus takes pity on the great love of the princess Ariadne and unravels the winding paths of his own baffling maze, guiding the blind steps of Theseus with a thread. You too, Icarus, would have taken no small place in this great work, had the grief of Daedalus allowed it. Twice your father tried to shape your fall in gold, and twice his hands fell helpless. The Trojans would have gone on gazing and read the whole story through, but Achates, who had been sent ahead, now returned, bringing with him Deiphobe, the daughter of Glaucus, priestess of Phoebus and Trivia, who spoke these words to the king. This is no time for you to be looking at sights like these. Rather, at this moment, you should be sacrificing 7 bullocks from a herd the yoke has never touched, and 7 yearling sheep, as ritual prescribes. So she addressed Aeneas. Nor were the Trojans slow to obey, and when the sacrifices were performed, she called them into the lofty temple. This rocky citadel had been colonized by Chalcidians from Euboea, and one side of it had been hollowed out to form a vast cavern into which led 100 broad shafts, 100 mouths from which streamed as many voices, giving the responses of the Sibyl. They had reached the threshold of the cavern when the virgin priestess cried, "Now is the time to ask your destinies. It is the god. The god is here." At that moment, as she spoke in front of the doors, her face was transfigured, her colour changed, her hair fell in disorder about her head, and she stood there with heaving breast and her wild heart bursting in ecstasy. She seemed to grow in stature and to speak as no mortal had ever spoken when the god came to her in his power and breathed upon her. "Why are you hesitating, Trojan Aeneas?" she cried. "Until you have prayed, the great mouths of my house are dumb and will not open." She spake and said no more. A cold shiver ran through the very bones of the Trojans, and their king poured out the prayers from the depths of his heart. "Phoebus Apollo, you have always pitied the cruel sufferings of the Trojans. You guided the hands of Trojan Paris and the arrow he sent into the body of Achilles. You were my leader as I set out upon all the oceans that lap the great lands of the earth and reached the far-flung peoples of Massilia and the fields that lie out to sea in front of the Syrtes. Now, at long last, we lay hold upon the shores of Italy that have so often receded before us. I pray that from this moment the fortunes of Troy may follow us no further. You too, you gods and goddesses who could not endure Troy and the great glory of the race of Dardanus, it is now right that you should have mercy upon the people of Pergamon. And you, O most holy priestess, you who know in advance what it is to be, grant my prayer, for the kingdom I ask for is no more than what is owed me by the fates. And allow the Trojans and their homeless and harried gods to settle in Latium. Then I shall found a temple of solid marble to Phoebus and Trivia, and holy days in the name of Phoebus. And for you too, there will be a great shrine in our kingdom. Here I shall establish your oracle and the riddling prophecies you have given my people. And I shall dedicate chosen priests to your gracious service. Only do not consign your prophecies to leaves to be confused and mocked by every wind that blows. Sing them in your own voice, I beg of you. He said no more. But the priestess was still in wild frenzy in her cave and still resisting Apollo. The more she tried to shake her body free of the great god, the harder he strained upon her foaming mouth, taming that wild heart and moulding her by his pressure. And now the 100 huge doors of her house opened of their own accord and gave her answer to the winds. "At long last you have done with the perils of the ocean, but worse things remain for you to bear on land. The sons of Dardanus shall come into their kingdom in Lavinium. Put that fear out of your mind. But it is a coming they will wish they had never known. I see wars, deadly wars. I see the Tibris, River Tiber, foaming with torrents of blood. There you will find a Simois and a Xanthus. There too will be a Greek camp. A second Achilles is already born in Latium, and he too is the son of a goddess. Juno too is part of Trojan destiny, and will never be far away when you are a suppliant begging in dire need among all the peoples and all the cities of Italy. Once again, the cause of all this Trojan suffering will be a foreign bride, another marriage with a stranger. You must not give way to these adversities, but must face them all the more boldly wherever your fortune allows it. Your road to safety, strange as it may seem, will start from a Greek city." With these words from her shrine, The Sibyl of Cumae sang her fearful, riddling prophecies, her voice booming in the cave as she wrapped the truth in darkness, while Apollo shook the reins upon her in her frenzy and dug the spurs into her flanks. The madness passed. The wild words died upon her lips, and the hero Aeneas began to speak. O virgin princess, suffering cannot come to me in any new or unforeseen form. I have already known it. Deep in my heart, I have lived it all before. One prayer I have. Since they say the gate of the king of the underworld is here, and here too is the black swamp which the tide of Acheron floods, I pray to be allowed to go and look upon the face of my dear father, Anchises. Show me the way and open the sacred doors for me. On these shoulders I carried him away through the flames and a hail of weapons and rescued him from the middle of his enemies. He went on my journey with me over all the oceans and endured all the threats of sea and sky, feeble as he was, but finding a strength beyond his years. Besides, it was my father himself who begged and commanded me to come to you as a suppliant and approach your doors. Pity the father, O gracious one, and pity the son, I beg of you. All things are within your power, and Hecate had her purpose in giving you charge of the grove of Avernus. Was not Orpheus allowed to summon the shade of his wife with the sound of the strings of his Thracian lyre? And when Pollux was allowed to redeem his brother by sharing his death, did he not often travel that road, and often return? Do I need to speak of Theseus, or of great Hercules? I, too, am descended from highest Jupiter. While he was still speaking these words of prayer, with his hand upon the altar, the prophetess began her answer. Trojan, son of Anchises, sprung from the blood of the gods, it is easy to go down to the underworld. The door of black Dis stands open night and day. But to retrace your steps and escape to the upper air, that is the task, that is the labour. Some few have succeeded, sons of the gods, loved and favoured by Jupiter, or raised to the heavens by the flame of their own virtue. The middle of that world is filled with woods, and the river Cocytus glides round them, holding them in its dark embrace. But if your desire is so great, if you have so much longing to sail twice upon the pools of Styx, and twice to see black Tartarus, if it is your pleasure to indulge this labour of madness, listen to what must first be done. Hidden in a dark tree, there is a golden bough. Golden are its leaves and its pliant stem, and it is sacred to Proserpina, the Juno of the underworld. A whole grove conceals it, and the shades of a dark, encircling valley close it in. But no man may enter the hidden places of the earth before plucking the golden foliage and fruit from this tree. The beautiful Proserpina has ordained that this is the offering that must be brought to her. When one golden branch has been torn from that tree, another comes to take its place, and the stem puts forth leaves of the same metal. So then, lift up your eyes and look for it, and when in due time you find it, take it in your hand and pluck it. If you are a man called by the fates, it will come easily of its own accord. But if not, No strength will prevail against it, and hard steel will not be able to hack it off. Besides, you have a friend lying dead. Of this you know nothing, but his body is polluting the whole fleet while you linger here at our door asking for oracles. First, you must carry him to his place of rest and lay him in a tomb. Then you must bring black cattle to begin the purification. When all this is done, you will be able to see the groves of sticks and the kingdom where no living man may set foot. So she spoke, and no other word would cross her lips. With downcast eyes and sorrowing face, Aeneas walked from the cave, revolving in his mind the fulfilment of these dark prophecies. With him, stride for stride, went the faithful Achates, and his heart was no less heavy. Long did they talk, and many different thoughts they shared. Who was this dead comrade of whom the priestess spoke? Whose body was this that had to be buried? And when they came to the shore, there above the tide line, they found the body of Misenus, who had died a death he had not deserved. Misenus, son of Aeolus, who had no equal at summoning the troops with his trumpet and kindling the god of war with his music, had been the comrade of great Hector, and by Hector's side had borne the brunt of battle, excelling not only with the trumpet, but also with the spear. But after Achilles had defeated Hector and taken his life, the brave Misenus had found no less a hero to follow, by joining Aeneas of the stock of Dardanus. Then, one day, in his folly, he happened to be blowing into a seashell, sending the sound ringing over the waves, and challenged the gods to play as well as he. At this, his rival Triton, if the tale is to be believed, had caught him up and drowned him in the surf among the rocks. So then they raised around his body a loud noise of lamentation, not least the dutiful Aeneas. Without delay they hastened, still weeping, to obey the commands of the Sibyl, gathering trees to build an altar which would be his tomb, and striving to raise it to the skies. Into the ancient forest they went, among the deep lairs of wild beasts. Down came the pines. The ilex rang under the axe. Beams of ash and oak were split along the grain with wedges, and they rolled great manna ashes down from the mountains. Aeneas took the lead in all this work, urging on his comrades and carrying at his side the same tools as they. But he was always gloomily turning one thought over in his mind as he looked at the measureless forest, and he chanced to utter it in this prayer. If only that golden bough would now show itself to us in this great grove, since everything the priestess said about Misenus has proved only too true. No sooner had he spoken than two doves chanced to come flying out of the sky and settle there on the grass in front of him. Then the great Aeneas knew they were his mother's birds, and he was glad. "Be my guides," he prayed, "if there is a way, and direct your swift flight through the air into the grove where the rich branch shades the fertile soil. And you, goddess, my mother, do not fail me in my time of uncertainty." So he spoke, and waited to see what signs they would give, and in what direction they would move. They flew and fed and flew again, always keeping in sight of those who followed. Then, when they came to the evil-smelling throat of Avernus, first they soared and then they swooped down through the clear air and settled where Aeneas had prayed they would settle, on the top of the tree that was two trees, from whose green there gleamed the breath of gold along the branch. Just as the mistletoe, not sown by the tree on which it grows, puts out fresh foliage in the woods in the cold of winter, and twines its yellow fruit round slender tree trunks, so shone the golden foliage on the dark ilex, so rustled the golden foil in the gentle breeze. Aeneas seized the branch instantly. It resisted, but he broke it off impatiently and carried it into the house of the priestess, the Sibyl. All this time, the Trojans on the shore did not cease to weep for Misenus and pay their last tributes to his ungrateful ashes. First, they built a huge pyre with rich pine torches and oak logs, and wove dark-leaved branches into its sides, setting up funeral cypresses in front of it and crowning it with his shining armour. Some prepared hot water in cauldrons, and when it was seething over the flames, they washed and anointed the cold body and raised their lament. When they had wept their fill, they placed him on the bier and draped him in his familiar purple robes. Others then performed their sad duty of carrying the bier and held their torches to the bottom of the pyre with averted faces after the practice of their ancestors. Then all the heaped-up offerings burned, the incense, the sacrificial food, the bowls filled with oil. After the embers had collapsed and the flames died down, they washed with wine the thirsty ashes that were all that remained of him, and Corineus collected his bones and sealed them in a bronze casket. 3 times he carried them in solemn ritual round the comrades of Misenus, and sprinkled the heroes lightly with pure water from the branch of a fruitful olive tree, uttering words of farewell as he performed the lustration. But dutiful Aeneas raised a great mound as a tomb and set on it the hero's arms, the oars he rowed with, and the trumpet he had blown. There, near the airy top of Mount Misenus, which bears his name now and forever through all years to come. As soon as this was done, he hastened to carry out the commands of the Sibyl. There was a huge, deep cave with jagged pebbles underfoot, and a gaping mouth guarded by dark woods and the black waters of a lake. No bird could wing its flight over this cave and live, so deadly was the breath that streamed out of that black throat and up into the vault of heaven. Hence the Greek name, Aornos, the place without birds. Here, first of all, the priestess stood 4 black-backed bullocks and poured wine upon their foreheads. She then plucked the bristles from the peak of their foreheads between their horns to lay upon the altar fires as a first offering, and lifted up her voice to call on Hecate, mighty in the sky and mighty in Erebus. Attendants put the knife to the throat and caught the warm blood in bowls. Aeneas himself took his sword and sacrificed a black-fleeced lamb to Night, the mother of the Furies, and her sister Earth, and to Proserpina a barren cow. Then he set up a night altar for the worship of the Stygian king, and laid whole carcasses of bulls on its flames, and poured rich oil on the burning entrails. Then suddenly, just before the sun had crossed his threshold in the sky and begun to rise, the earth bellowed underfoot. The wooded ridges quaked, and dogs could be heard howling in the darkness. It was the arrival of the goddess. "Stand apart, all you who are unsanctified," cried the priestess. "Stand well apart. The whole grove must be free of your presence. You, Aeneas, must enter upon your journey. Draw your sword from the sheath. Now you need your courage. Now let your heart be strong." With these words, she moved in a trance into the open cave, and step for step, Aeneas strode fearlessly along behind her. "You gods who rule the world of the spirits, you silent shades and chaos and phlegethone, you dark and silent wastes, let it be right for me to tell what I have been told. Let it be with your divine blessing that I reveal what is hidden deep in the mists beneath the earth." They walked in the darkness of that lonely night, with shadows all about them, through the empty halls of Dis and his desolate kingdom. As men walk in a wood by the sinister light of a fitful moon, when Jupiter has buried the sky in shade and black night has robbed all things of their colour. Before the entrance hall of Orcus, in the very throat of hell, grief and revenge have made their beds, and old age lives there in despair, with white-faced diseases and fear and hunger, corrupter of men, and squalid poverty, things dreadful to look upon, and death and drudgery besides. Then there are sleep, death's sister, perverted pleasures, murderous war astride the threshold, the iron chambers of the Furies, and raving discord with blood-soaked ribbons binding her viperous hair. In the middle, a huge dark elm spreads out its ancient arms, the resting place, so they say, of flocks of idle dreams, one clinging under every leaf. Here, too, are all manner of monstrous beasts, centaurs stabling inside the gate, Scyllas, half dogs, half women, Briareus with his 100 heads, the Hydra of Lerna hissing fiercely, the Chimera armed in fire, Gorgons and Harpies, and the triple phantom of Geryon. Now Aeneas drew his sword in sudden alarm to meet them with naked steel as they came at him. And if his wise companion had not warned him that this was the fluttering of disembodied spirits, a mere semblance of living substance, he would have rushed upon them and parted empty shadows with steel. Here begins the road that leads to the rolling waters of Acheron, the river of Tartarus. Here is a vast quagmire of boiling whirlpools which belches sand and slime into Cocytus, and these are the rivers and waters guarded by the terrible Charon in his filthy rags. On his chin there grows a thick grey beard, never trimmed. His glaring eyes are lit with fire, and a foul cloak hangs from a knot at his shoulder. With his own hands he plies the pole and sees to the sails as he ferries the dead in a boat the colour of burnt iron. He is no longer young, but, being a god, enjoys rude strength and a green old age. The whole throng of the dead was rushing to this part of the bank. Mothers, men, great-hearted heroes whose lives were ended. Boys, unmarried girls and young men laid on the pyre before the faces of their parents. As many as are the leaves that fall in the forest at the first chill of autumn. As many as the birds that flock to land from deep ocean when the cold season of the year drives them over the sea to lands bathed in sun. There they stood begging to be allowed to be the first to cross, and stretching out their arms in longing for the further shore. But the grim boatman takes some here and some there, and others he pushes away far back from the sandy shore. Aeneas, amazed and distressed by all this tumult, cried out, "Tell me, virgin priestess, what is the meaning of this crowding to the river? What do the spirits want? Why are some pushed away from the bank, while others sweep the livid water with their oars?" The aged Sibyl made this brief reply. "Son of Anchises, beyond all doubt the offspring of the gods, what you are seeing is the deep pools of the Cocytus and the swamp of the Styx, by whose divine power the gods are afraid to swear and lie. The throng you see on this side are the helpless souls of the unburied. The ferryman there is Charon. Those sailing the waters of the Styx have all been buried. No man may be ferried from fearful bank to fearful bank of this roaring current until his bones are laid to rest. Instead, they wander for 100 years, fluttering around these shores until they are at last allowed to return to the pools they have so longed for." The son of Anchises checked his stride and stood stock still, with many thoughts cursing through his mind as he pitied their cruel fate. When there, among the sufferers, lacking all honour in death, he caught sight of Leucaspis and Orontes, the captain of the Lycian fleet, men who had started with him from Troy, sailed the wind-torn seas, and been overwhelmed by gales from the south that rolled them in the ocean, ships and crews. Next, he saw coming towards him his helmsman Palinurus, who had fallen from the ship's stern and plunged into the sea while watching the stars on the recent crossing from Libya. Aeneas recognised this sorrowing figure with difficulty in the dark shadow, and was the first to speak. "What god was it, Palinurus, that took you from us and drowned you in mid-ocean? Come, tell me, for this is the one response of Apollo that has misled me. I have never found him false before. He prophesied that you would be safe upon the sea and would reach the boundaries of Ausonia. Is this how he keeps his promise?" "O great leader, son of Anchises," replied Palinurus, "the bowl and the tripod of Apollo has not deceived you, and no god drowned me in the sea. While I was holding course and gripping the tiller which it was my charge to guard, it was broken off by some mighty force, and I dragged it down with me as I fell. I swear by the wild sea that I felt no fear for myself, to equal my fear that your ship might come to grief, stripped of its steering, and with its pilot pitched into the sea, and that great swell rising. 3 long winter nights the wind blew hard from the south, and carried me over seas I could not measure, till, when light came on the 4th day, and a wave lifted me to its crest, I could just make out the land of Italy. I swam slowly to shore, and was on the point of reaching safety, when a tribe of ruffians set upon me with their knives, weighed down as I was by my wet clothes, and clinging by my fingertips to the jagged rocks at the foot of a cliff. Knowing nothing of me, they made me their plunder. And now I am at the mercy of the winds, and the waves are turning my body over at the water's edge. But I beg of you, by the joyous light and winds of heaven, by your father, by your hopes of Iulus as he grows to manhood, you who have never known defeat, rescue me from this anguish. either throw some earth on my body. You can do that. Just steer back to the harbours of Velia. Or else, if there is a way, and the goddess who gave you life shows it to you. For I do not believe you're preparing to sail these great rivers and the swamp of the Styx, unless the blessing of the gods is with you. Take pity on me. Give me your right hand. Take me aboard and carry me with you over the waves, so that in death at least I can be at peace in a place of quiet. These were the words of Palinurus. And this was the reply of the Sibyl. How did you conceive this monstrous desire, Palinurus? How can you, who are unburied, hope to set eyes on the river Styx and the pitiless waters of the Furies? How can you come near the bank unbidden? You must cease to hope that the fates of the gods can be altered by prayers. But hear my words, remember them, and find comfort for your sad case. The people who live far and wide in all their cities round the place where you died will be driven by signs from heaven to consecrate your bones. They will raise a burial mound for you, and to that mound will pay their annual tribute, and the place will bear the name of Palinurus for all time to come. At these words his sorrows were removed, and the grief was driven from that sad heart for a short time. He rejoiced in the land that was to bear his name.